I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today we're talking to the creator of one of my favorite places. Katherine Gustafson is an award-winning landscape architect and the designer of Chicago's Lurie Garden. We'll talk to Katherine about creating a place of serenity in a bustling city. Dr. Nancy Zimpfer is the Chancellor of the State University of New York. With 64 campuses and almost a half million students, Dr. Zimpfer believes she has the assets that will make the difference in New York's future. Two powerful women, plus the latest from Planet Edison and our City Views commentator Walker Smith, today on Smart City, right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Katherine Gustafson established her landscape architecture practice in Paris in 1980, beginning as the sole practitioner in collaboration with architects, artists, and engineers. She now works worldwide from her offices in London and in Seattle, and she's the creator of one of my favorite city places, Chicago's Lurie Garden. Katherine, you've made one of my favorite places in the world, Lurie Garden in Chicago's Millennium Park. When you were asked to design Lurie Garden, what was the assignment?
The original brief asked for a place of rare and unusual plants that I believe the intent was to show the people of Chicago a larger array of plants that they could actually use within their own landscapes, that it was one of the leading factors why Pete Oldoff and I joined a partnership on this, because he is a perennial plant expert, and he brought that knowledge to the project.
I'm surprised by the simplicity of the brief. It's such a fabulous place.
I mean, obviously, there's more to the brief than that. It's make a place, make a garden, you know, things like that. But it was never intended to be, you know, a children's playground or anything else. It was competition. There were quite a few people who entered it.
It is such a contrast to the rest of the park. Was that intentional?
Quietness is always intentional. And our work tends to go towards a serenity. The places of thinking, I often feel that we have information overload, that we don't have places where we just stop and think. And I think we could eliminate a number of problems if we took the time or had places that gave us that calmness to actually think about things in our life. Now, the other issue or problem or aspect of this is that it's purposely different from the rest of the park. Why do things that are the same as the rest of the park? You want to give people diverse experiences. So the fact that next to it was Gary's Bandshell, which is a vast open space, we very purposely made this a very full space so that you could have that transition and have that diversity of space. There's another thing that to really understand about the Lurie Garden is that most of the people that go to the Bandshell, 10,000 people is what it normally holds, the majority of those people actually park underneath the Lurie Garden. And that the entrance to those parking garages are on the facade of Monroe Street. So if you look at a plan, you can imagine what it would look like, 10,000 people going from the Bandshell straight across the garden into these garage entrances. So I really wanted a secret garden, a quiet garden. So we created a very large hedge that we called the shoulder hedge to protect that garden and also to guide people around the core of the garden, the center, the heart of the garden, to the garage entrances.
You talk about the value of places of serenity, places to think. Is there a formula for making those places?
I think there's just sort of basic good design. One, making sure you feel safe, that you feel like you aren't going to get caught up in some sort of trouble of some sort, you know, whether it's physical, falling off something, or being aggressed by somebody. I think it's also making places where you control the sound. and make sure that you make them as quiet as possible. There's the other issue is water is always a very contemplative piece. I like water. I like working with it. And it adds to that serenity and discover and light. Water is a little bit like a fireplace. It always is dancing. And so it fascinates people. It pulls you into a certain meditative state. The other secret, which is just a good design secret, is to really make that you've taken clues from the place you're in, so it's very specific to your site. Sun, wind, history. So it feels like it's natural to the site and it's not in contradiction to the site. Also gives that more of a harmonious feeling to the piece.
How did we fall into a pattern of every park having to have a playground?
Oh, we fall into a lot of patterns. I mean, that's not the only one. There's that every park has to be a play area, has to be full of festivities and programming and games and festivals. And for me, one of the biggest problems with public space right now is people are looking to it to create revenue to pay for itself and pay for its own maintenance. A public space is civic. It's a civic responsibility. And so finding the budgets to actually build and maintain these, instead of putting the pressure on the space itself, we need to put the pressure on something else. Now, the Laurie Garden was very lucky in that it has a $10 million endowment for the maintenance. And that didn't happen just by accident. People worked at getting that endowment. People worked at making sure that there was the money there to maintain it, that it doesn't have to do gymnastics, aerobics to earn money, this garden, to maintain itself. And that's what's happening in many, many of our public spaces, that they are becoming commercial spaces just to maintain themselves.
You mentioned festivities as a pattern that has emerged for parks. Millennium Park, of course, is very programmed, and I keep thinking, don't let the festivities invade Laurie Garden.
Well, Laurie Garden's too fragile. It can't take that. And that wasn't its program. Its program was rare and unusual plants. It was really a storybook for people of what can you grow in the Chicago area. Now, working on Grant Park is one of my favorite gardens in the world. I think it's a fantastic park. It can take those festivities. It can take the taste of Chicago. It's wonderful having it programmed. But it has such an historical nature, and it has such strong bones that it can, you know, absorb things on a temporary basis. It's when they become permanent, that's when I find it difficult, that the space starts to lose its civicness.
Tell me about the work you've done in Grant Park.
We have not done anything in Grant Park except for an exercise about how to program different spaces. And that is a guide for the municipality to understand what type of programs work in which space better.
Explain what you mean by program.
Program can be anything. An example, I've got the Tulip Society that wants to put on a tulip show. And they're going to come in there with flats of tulips or dahlias or whatever and put on a flower show for 2 weeks. That's a program. I want to put up the Taste of Chicago. That's a programmed event. I want to have a concert that also has ballet. That's a program.
How does color figure into your plans for a garden such as Laurie Garden?
I think color is an additive. It creates a mood. So it depends on what type of mood you would like, what type of mood is appropriate for the color of the sky and, you know, the nature you're in. You know, when you go to the tropics, the oranges and purples and reds look absolutely fantastic. When you get into northern climates, different colors look better. I mean, it's all about what grows. It's about the mood. I think it's more than anything, it's about the mood. When you look at red, you do not feel the same as when you look at pale blue. And you don't, if you put a pale blue sweater on or you put a red sweater on, you don't feel the same.
Do you use color to contribute to a feeling of serenity?
Serenity, or if you're designing a park that you do not want to be serene, but you want it to be more hip-hop or jovial or like a skateboard park, then you probably would use different kind of colors. it depends on what you're trying to create and what feelings that you're hoping to incite or help people have.
Lurie Garden is built on two levels. It has a noticeable slope on one level. I presume that was intentional because you've built this park on top of a parking garage, so you didn't exactly start with a natural landscape. Was that slope intentional, and what effect does that have on the visitor?
I think the reason that is done is the concept behind the Lurie Garden, besides rare unusual plants, but the real concept is to talk about the history of Chicago. And Chicago was a city that used to be built in the marsh and used to be all the walking was on wood decks and things like that. And then the Great Fire came and the whole city burned down. So they rebuilt Chicago, but they rebuilt it 9 feet up out of the marsh. So there's basically two areas in this garden. One is called the dark plate, which is the area which was very dappled light, marsh, you know, that type of thing. And then there's the light plate, which is the big, large open area, which is very much about the prairie, about the future, and it's about lifting up. So you have this seam between those two, which is about 6 or 7 feet tall, but it represents that Chicago building up. And it also represents there is a seawall that is exactly on this line way down in the ground that was the seawall that was originally built to keep the lake out of the railroad tracks. That limestone wall still exists in that position. So it talks about man, how man has built these walls or built these elevations to protect themselves from water, from flooding, and thus, in the end, from fire.
What makes a good public client for you? A client that allows you to do your best work?
It's a client who actually has dialogue and a client who is participatory. A client that just sits back and doesn't have a dialogue, you never quite know if you're doing the right thing for them. You never know if you're moving in the right direction. And the biggest fear is that you're not, and that they're going to wake up one day and say, oh, I don't like this. And so that it's very inefficient to have a client just stay silent. You want the client to bring forward to the table their knowledge. You also want a client that wants to learn. A client that comes in, or like anybody, saying, I know everything, is really quite boring. It doesn't allow for any evolution by their part or your part. It's sort of like somebody coming in saying, I want this picture. Will you paint me that picture? That's the kind of client I do not want, because that means there's no discovery for them of the picture, and I have no discovery in doing the picture because it's already set.
How do you help a client to find their voice, to engage in a dialogue with you? Surely many of your clients come to the work without a lot of background.
But they have other language. I think and some people, you just have to find out how they speak and what are the ways they speak. Sometimes I've had some very interesting clients that weren't interested in the landscape at all. So you end up bringing them books or you take them places. And landscape is a pretty positive element. There's very few people that don't eventually just get very touched by it. And it's just, how do you open the doors so people can actually see it and can understand what the different vibrations are within it?
How should your work be evaluated?
I have no clue.
Well, how do you evaluate your work?
I mean, if I was unhappy with something, it would never get off my table.
Haven't you made some compromises along the way that didn't make you happy?
I think compromise is a wrong word. There's trying to understand what the public needs, what the client needs, what the budget needs, what the city needs. And it's a process of finding that right solution that fits everything. I don't expect to go out there and do 5 lines on a piece of paper and build them. I mean, that's not how it works. These are long, complicated public jobs, and I like the bigger and the more complicated they are, the happier I am. And they're fascinating that way.
What reaction do you want your work to provoke, or is it different depending on the project?
It's different depending on the project, but I think self-evidence, harmony, peace are, the three words.
Whose work in the field do you most admire and why?
André Lenôtre. I mean, he's the master at space. He's absolutely incredible. I know it's 17th century, but it's still some of the most beautiful work for 18th century. It's still very contemporary. Some of the most beautiful landscape work in the world is still Vauban and Versailles. I never tire of going back in lessons and lessons and lessons by this man.
What are you working on that you can tell us about?
We just won a competition for Vancouver, Washington. We're very excited about. There is a large lid covering of the I-5 freeway. Very large, that is going to reconnect Vancouver, Washington with the historic Fort Vancouver. It's a very important piece. There's this absolutely beautiful piece of land called Fort Vancouver that's going to be turned over completely to the Parks Department in 2 years, which means it is going to be one of the biggest public parks in the Northwest that has historical core on it also. And so this piece will be a way to mend this scar that I-5 has done to cut this town in half from this historical core and also bring a whole new native landscape and didactic landscape to the area.
It sounds fabulous.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We're very, very happy with it. It was complicated to do, but we just won the competition with Allied Works, AWA, out of Portland, who is Brad Copefield, a very well-known and wonderful architect.
Are there any new trends in landscape architecture that you think will affect your future work?
I think there's trends in our world, and one's called sustainability in our environment, that will change how everybody lives and how everybody works.
How are you incorporating sustainability into your work?
You have another 12 hours. It's very complex, but it's everything from water to material uses to travel distance. They're to meet the criteria that is set forth by LEEDS is one aim, but it's to go beyond LEEDS and do best practice also.
Do you know what best practice is?
Never know. It changes every day. But that's what makes it interesting, is to make sure that every day you open up a new door and take a really good look.
Catherine, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City. And thank you from me for making the Laurie Garden so special.
I'm really glad you like the Laurie Garden. The other place that you might want to visit that I love that we did was the American Museum of Natural History in New York, the plaza off the planetarium. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Catherine Gustafson now works throughout the world from two offices, one in London, one in Seattle. Her award-winning landscapes can be seen around the world from Lebanon to Wales. And now for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
It's been 4 years since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the town of New London, Connecticut could seize private land in the name of economic development. What inspired that landmark case was a 9-acre urban village the city was planning to construct to entice pharmaceutical giant Pfizer to move a 1,400-person office into town. The ploy worked, and Pfizer opened its office in New London. The 2005 Supreme Court ruling allowed the city to seize those 9 acres of land, but this month Pfizer announced that it was packing up and moving out of town, according to a report from the New York Times. On top of that, the planned urban village was never even built. So now the city is left with a blank spot of seized land, 1,400 fewer jobs, and a collection of homeowners whose property was taken, demolished, and replaced with nothing. Meanwhile, New York City is dealing with a similar situation, though in a more optimistic light. A private developer had been buying up land in and around the Coney Island Amusement Park since 2005 with grand plans to remake the area as a Las Vegas-like destination. But those plans never developed, and the community is left with empty lots where local landmarks once stood. But now the city of New York is coming to what it and many locals hope will be the rescue. The city recently inked a deal to purchase about 7 acres of land in the middle of Coney Island, according to the New York Times. Officials are hopeful that they can lure a developer to bring a year-round amusement park back to the hobbled area. And finally, the downturn in the economy and the housing market is inspiring an era of change among home builders. Housing developers across the nation are watching the demand for huge houses fall and are slashing square footage in response. A recent article from the Wall Street Journal looks at a number of home builders who are ditching their 4,700 square foot floor plans and sizing things down to more affordable proportions. Floor plans are dropping under 3,000 or even 2,000 square feet for many of these home builders who had made a mint with 5,000 square foot McMansions during the housing boom. The crash caused many of them to rethink their strategies. And now that demand for housing is beginning to climb again, homeowners are finding that buyers are steering away from supersized McMansions and towards smaller houses they can actually afford. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we'll have a conversation with Dr. Nancy Zempfer. She'll tell us about how the State University of New York is working to improve the state's economy, its education, and its quality of life. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Dr. Nancy Zempfer is the Chancellor of the State University of New York, better known as SUNY. Nancy, you have 64 campuses and 460,000 students in the State University of New York system. What is key to your success with that many campuses and that many students?
Well, as you might imagine, Carol, just getting them all rounded up and working collaboratively for any cause would be important. In fact, the reason I was so attracted to the State University of New York is that we do have this diversity and complexity. But our primary goal is to organize ourselves in the direction of one very big idea, and that is that we can be a critical factor in the state of New York's economic revitalization and enhanced quality of life.
How do you do that? How does a university become a critical factor in the economic revitalization of a state?
Well, that's an interesting question, Carol, because I think most of our listeners who know anything about higher education would assume that this is a story we've been telling for decades, all the way back to the Morrill Act and the land grant legislation. It has been known by broad communities that we are critical to economic success. But interestingly enough, it doesn't seem to be enough to just assert that you are an economic engine. I think we have to show people in ways that all of our economic impact studies have not registered. So I can tell you how SUNY's doing it. We are organizing and in the midst, actually, of a very comprehensive strategic planning process where we have made known to all constituent parties that our goal is not inward-looking. We will never give up on our mission of teaching, research, and service, and we always talk about how we can be better. But our goal in this critical time is to say to the state of New York, you know what? You are our highest client. The state's revitalization, the revival of our revenue streams, putting people to work, providing jobs, and enhancing the quality of life so that people will not only stay here who live here, but people will come here to stay to live and raise their families. So I think we're doing it in a very practical and applied way, and I hope that people will be responsive to that.
There are things that universities have traditionally done that, of course, add to any state or community's economy. You employ people, you develop real estate, you purchase goods and services, you train people. So you do a lot of things in the course of the everyday life of a university that adds to the economy. And of course, I would consider research your R&D work that you do. Are there additional things that, as university chancellor of such a large system, that you will be intentional about that you think will have additional value when it comes to the economic revitalization of the state?
You know, Carol, the jumping off place here is that most institutions, and particularly research universities, have on a regular basis, every couple of years or so, issued reports on the economic impact of that particular campus on either the community or the state or even the region of the country in which they reside. And we've become masters at that. And usually it does tiptoe across the various issues that you've mentioned. But still, what would explain the fact that universities are sort of the last to be fed and early on the cut list when states are having to restrict their financial support and having such budget problems as states are today. So I think what we have maybe risky, but nonetheless assumed, is that we need to even probe deeper. So as we are thinking about the strategic planning process, the first big news is that we would be so overt about our mission being focused at this time on economic revitalization and quality of life. And you notice I mentioned quality of life because it's not all about jobs and employment. It's a lot about what's it like to live here. But we are taking that concept one step further. I think this is the answer to your question. We are looking at six strategic directions that, if employed, you know, with a vengeance around a metric, actually moving the dial in a particular direction, we can absolutely show that having the State University in New York is making a difference in the lives of New Yorkers. And they are at the moment working hypotheses. That is to say, we're testing out on literally hundreds, if not thousands of people in our broad constituency, whether these are the right levers for really revitalizing New York's economy. But in no particular order, we are very good. We have great capacity in energy and sustainability. So that's one theme. Secondly, in healthcare, the life sciences, the distribution of quality healthcare professionals to our underserved areas. Thirdly, what is our role in globalization? We know that we live in this flat world. What are we really doing about it that will help New York really thrive in a global economy and in a global environment? And then one of my personal favorites, what are we doing toward the education pipeline that is leaking severely at this time? Kids are not graduating from high school, let alone graduating from high school ready for college. Fifthly, and I'm almost to the end, what are we doing in arts and culture? We have so much talent across our institutions to enhance the quality of life in our communities around the humanities, around art, around performance, around philosophy, around all of the social sciences. And then finally, sort of in the spirit of Richard Florida, what are we doing to enhance place? What is our role in quality places? So our thought is that with and across those six themes, we could motivate or move our teaching and learning in that direction. We could bring to bear our research and innovation and, of course, the quality of our programs and our service to community. So I think it's a bit of a risk, actually. I think we're getting very focused on what is SUNY's ability to move the needle in reducing our carbon footprint, in having a better place in the world, in advancing healthcare and moving our graduates into underserved areas, actually closing the leaks in the pipeline. So the risk here, Carol, and you know this best from CEOs for Cities, when you identify powerful metrics and then you say, guess what, folks, we're going to put our shoulder to the wheel and try to move these metrics, you take a risk. You make yourself vulnerable, but in the end, I think that really is the key to our success.
Nancy, you talk about plugging the leaky pipeline, and as you know, many universities and certainly even more community colleges have pretty lousy graduation rates. I mean, sometimes they're not much better and sometimes actually worse than the K-12 systems that we complain about so much. A lot of students simply start college but never finish. What are you doing in the SUNY system to serve adult students with some college credit but no completion?
Well, I guess first I would say I think we've all been a bit misled by the notion of swing the doors wide open, be committed to access, without fully understanding that to be successful in college, you have to do what you have to do in K-12. That is to say, you have to take the tough courses, you have to stay in school, you have to expose yourself to the broadest array of knowledge and learn about teamwork and learn about what it takes to be successful in the workforce and the workplace. And so I can tell you that first and foremost, for students of any age, SUNY's commitment is to be a better partner with our colleagues in early childhood and K-12, and on the other end, to be a much better partner with people who who do workforce development. But I would particularly like to see us reach out to adults with some education. You know, the phrase low-hanging fruit. That is low-hanging fruit. These are people who at one point in time engaged in the education pipeline. And then for whatever reason, either because at that time you could get a job without much advanced education or they were dropping out of the workforce for other reasons, they need to come back. We need to bring them back. And I think what we're doing is making our programming more accessible. We're doing a lot with learning centers and outreach centers. We're going into our communities. If our campuses happen to be out a bit, we're moving centers into the center city. We're creating programs that adults most need, literacy programs that are foundational. We're working with corporate partners and industry partners to say, well, how many workers do you need in this field? And then we're trying to recruit more strategically. For a lot of adults, it's 24/7 learning. They're late at night. They're early in the morning. They might be working on some college credits while they're on the job. So we're doing a lot with distance learning. And I think this is something, again, that I'm so pleased about CEOs for Cities and the talent dividend is that you've given us some targets. We can actually look at a real number of adults who had some experience in the education pipeline whom we need to bring back. And I think that is going to be one of the targets of this strategic plan that we're developing. And again, I'm so excited to have some metrics that actually will show us when we're making progress.
When you think about the quality of K through 12 and the problem of students dropping out and then graduating but not really prepared to go on to higher education, what responsibility do you feel as a university leader, as chancellor of a big system that is, you know, let's face it, in fact, educating those teachers and those administrators who are running those systems that the product of which you're not particularly pleased with?
Well, you know, on the one hand, let me start at 30,000 feet and say that I don't really think we have a public system of education in this country. And that may be a good thing. It may, obviously, of our founding fathers, there might have been some intentionality to this. But what we're learning is that the pipeline is glued together by the relationship between one educational experience and another. So that now we know, I mean, the data are unequivocal. To be successful in kindergarten, you have to come to school ready to learn. You have to have had some early childhood access, and you have to have support in the home, and you have to be a healthy child. And if you don't come to kindergarten ready to learn, and we have pretty good data that suggests that over 50% of our kids don't have the privilege of coming to kindergarten ready or kindergarten ready, then we spend a lot of time making up for lost time in the early years. And I think now more than ever, we're beginning to understand that. We then also know that if you don't persist in elementary education, let's say you fall behind in the third and fourth grade and no remediation is offered at that time, then it'll become increasingly hard to remediate you in junior high school. And so it goes. So I think the biggest understanding about all of this is that there is a pipeline and that, you know, the bones are connected. And my role as a university president is not to point fingers and say to K-12, if you would just send us better, smarter students, we'd do a better, smarter job in college. My role is to help K-12 be successful. And why? Because we, as university people, prepare the teachers who prepare the kids who come to our college. So without going too deep into the business metaphor, we are talking about supply chain management, and we have dropped the ball, we collectively. And so I do feel that my role as a university president is to, if not state the obvious, it is to say, look, folks, we are only as good as we are. And since our teachers are leading the educational lives of young people who will ultimately come to our doors, we have to see our work as an ecosystem. And as a consequence, I have been a huge advocate for the convening power of university presidents as they exist in their lived communities. And where we see this leaky pipeline, let's stand up, let's set the table, let's get together and work effectively to seal these leaks. And as you know, Carol, that has been my experience most recently in Cincinnati and in my other Midwestern cities of Milwaukee and Columbus. And I am bringing that attitude. I sometimes say I'm a chancellor with an attitude. I am bringing that attitude to the state of New York.
Well, on the other end of things, do you think it's reasonable, Nancy, for communities to expect universities to produce students not who can simply work in the next economy, but who can create the next economy? And I'd be curious if the answer is yes, how can universities prepare their students to do that?
Well, almost everybody you talk to says that we couldn't possibly prepare for the next generation of work because we don't know what the next generation of work is going to be like. So we have to underscore the importance of preparing our students to be innovative thinkers, creative, able to work exceptionally well with others in teams, and able to articulate their thinking and create the environments for innovation. So innovation is a very high-minded but difficult concept to get our arms around. So at a practical level, Carol, I think that one of the things we're absolutely doing right is that increasingly we are matching our undergraduate students with faculty who are doing research. And, do not think that the only faculty members who are doing research reside in so-called research universities, because this summer I had the great privilege of actually visiting each of the 64 campuses of the State University of New York, and I saw faculty members doing a brand of research in community colleges, technical colleges, liberal arts colleges, and research universities. And so matching our students at any age, at any stage in their educational career, with people who understand innovation in the laboratory, in the performance hall, in the field, that is critically important to creating an innovative workforce. So it's the everyday practical matching up of our students with people whose lives, our faculty, are just entangled with creation and innovation.
You mentioned earlier what you've done to make your campuses in other communities more connected to their communities. And of course, you've got a lot of campuses and you've got a number of community colleges that are basically built on an automobile model. They're pretty much, buildings surrounded by parking lots in the same way a traditional shopping mall would be surrounded by parking lots. Do you ever imagine yourself being able to go back and sort of rethink the way those campuses situate in their community and how walkable they are, how connected they are to the rest of the community?
Well, I think we're all a bit guilty in the whole of land use of going where the land was. It's much more expensive to build in a dense environment. You have to build up. You have to think about how you raise a building in an environment that's already built out. And so it is what it is. SUNY developed largely in the 60s and 70s. Many of our campuses were built under the inspired leadership of Governor Rockefeller, who thought that having campuses distributed throughout the state was a good idea, and they took land where they had land. But what we're seeing now is that a number of our campuses are moving some part of their initiative downtown. And oh, that is such a boon to those cities. I don't think it means that it's an either or, that you can't have the residential campus that might be on the Beltway, but you can certainly have a downtown element. And for that matter, we see satellites in highly rural areas that are underserved as well. They're not particularly any better served by a suburban campus than the city. So one of the things we're doing, since we can't undo history and we have facilities that, about which we have to be very good stewards, is that we are occupying storefronts. We are moving into downtown shopping malls that have been long since evacuated as malls moved out to the suburbs. I mean, who started this? Where did this all come from? So we're using some of the space that was left to just fallow in our cities, and we're very excited about that. And that is changing, I think, the way we think about transportation. And I truly believe that where universities are can be catalytic to other core infrastructure issues like transportation.
Mm-hmm. How do you plan to play a role, Nancy, in New York's shrinking cities?
Well, in a kind of interesting way, as states like New York are losing population or have lost population, and believe me, we are looking at the demographic profile going forward, which suggests a reduction in high school graduates, capable and ready of coming to ready to come to our campuses. We know that at least a half a dozen states are in such a growth posture that the states themselves will not ever be able to respond or meet that demand. So I'm excited on the one hand about the possibility that we might, and you know, this is wild and crazy, but we might develop a partnership with a fast growing state to say, you know, I think we can relieve some of the pressure. You're not going to be able ever to build out your universities to meet the kind of demand that has, quite frankly, relocated to the Sunshine States. So, I mean, first of all, we have to tell everybody about the beauty and the extraordinary lifestyle of the state of New York so that they will understand why it would be great fun to come here. And then, you know, we're in such a rush to form international partnerships, which of course I love, but how about a partnership with a fast-growing state that cannot meet the immediate demands of its population, high school population? That and other ideas suggest that that we could be responsive and we could help rebuild New York in the process.
You referred to this earlier, Nancy, that if New York State is investing in higher education and then its graduates leave the state, you know, that's not a great financial deal for taxpayers in New York, right? Because they're investing in people who then don't produce commensurate revenue in the state. And I'm just curious, what can you do to keep your graduates in state? And what should you do?
Well, of course, everybody has always, well, the last decade or so, been quite worried about the so-called brain drain. And I guess I would preface my answer by saying that we are equally paying attention to the brain gain that comes from attracting out-of-state students to our campuses, thinking that if they come and go to school here, they will recognize the enhanced quality of life of the state of New York and therefore stay here. But I think, as I referenced earlier, a part of the SUNY strategic plan is to pay attention to quality places and that place matters. But I will take a page from my University of Cincinnati experience to say to you that there's another big idea out there that I think would really be helpful to us. And of course, you know, we have to be very convincing about this, but that's a thing called cooperative education or work-based learning. And this is the notion that during the academic experience, students are placed in work settings, in most cases proximate to where the campus is, but sometimes an international tour of duty or even a tour of duty in another state. But as long as it is tethered to a New York business or industry, as people may know, co-op or work integrated learning means that you do some work while you're in your academic program. You are typically paid for this work by the employer, and you get a great going over by prospective employers. They get to know you. They see what you're capable of. They actually help with your training and give wonderful feedback to the universities as well about what is state of the art in business and industry. And the odds are, and I know this from the data from University of Cincinnati, that you will be offered a job in one of these sites where you have a co-op placement, and in being offered that job, decide to stay to work and live in the state. So what could be better for New York than partnering up with our businesses and industries to get more of our undergraduates in those sites while they're still in school, earning some money, graduating on time, typically debt-free, by the way, and then getting a job offer in a New York company and staying to live here. So if you follow that bouncing ball, I think that's just a huge magnet for people to stay in New York after they graduate. And, you know, what's in the balance now, given our economy, is this notion of which comes first. You look for a place and then you find a job, or you look for a job and you find a place. I think both of those arguments will be in force for a long time, but how about get a job, stay? And that's one thing I think we'll discuss in earnest here in New York.
Mm-hmm. Why has the cost of college increased so much in the past decade? What's driving the cost?
Well, of course, this is a huge differential story. First, you sort out public versus private, and you know the differential between the cost of a private education versus what we're able to offer for high quality here in the State University of New York is absolutely remarkable. But I think that on the whole, higher education has become more of a discretionary budget item than an absolutely mandatory one. And states are truly overwhelmed by the cost of healthcare. that is absolutely true. The needs and the need to feed and support K-12 is a huge priority for every state. Unfortunately, the need to feed our criminal justice, or more importantly, our prison system, which could be fixed in a heartbeat if we were doing more with education and less putting people out on the street. But I guess we've just become, on the one hand, a bit more discretionary and therefore not funded as a high priority. And secondly, in some respects, we've become more expensive because we are producing at the highest levels some of the most high-end technology and laboratory needs and, you know, science. That's just a whole lot more expensive than it was 100 years ago. So there are a number of drivers, but I think what we have failed to understand is really the argument that's most important, and that is that higher education is a growth industry for our states. And instead of investing in things that aren't a growth industry, I mean, why would we want to grow our criminal justice system? Actually, on the contrary, we want to reduce the demand for our prisons and incarceration. And the only way you can really do that is to educate people away from the streets. And so we are going to all this trouble to develop, which I think we should, of course, anyway, a comprehensive strategic plan riveted on the economic revitalization and enhanced quality of life of the state of New York to say to New York, we are an investment you cannot afford to deny.
Nancy, one more question. What changes can we expect from our colleges and universities over the next decade? As you look out, what do you see that could surprise us or may change the way we think of colleges and universities and the contributions they make to our communities?
Well, I guess I'd start by the fact that what we've been through as a country in the last couple of years has been shocking to most. I do not think we can ever afford to find ourselves in this position again. And so I think the fate of our colleges and universities, our campuses, is now forever entwined with the health and welfare of our states and our country, our economies, and the quality of our life. So I think you are seeing the ultimate removal of any barriers that would distinguish the reciprocal welfare of our universities and our country as being a paramount connection. That doesn't mean we can't still be wonderful islands of meditation, creativity, and innovation, but never again can we ever become decoupled from what ails our society. And then, of course, I think secondarily, being more proactive, showing our public policymakers and our citizenry that we are real players in creating this future for our country and for the world will be a tantamount priority. And as a consequence, universities are going to have to be more fluid, more porous, more nimble. And I think we can do that. I think we are in many respects already there, but I think moving organizations to a new paradigm is challenging, but exciting and fun, and I think we will be there.
Nancy, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, thank you, Carol.
Dr. Nancy Zimpfer is the Chancellor of the State University of New York. Finally, this week, our City Views commentator Walker Smith is keeping his eye on the clock and to the little signs that time is passing.
I'm getting to the age now where I pay more attention to how I'm aging. And I've noticed that were it not for a couple of dead giveaways, it would be hard to peg people's age. So I've been taking more care about how I present myself to the world. For women, it's hands. If I'm making a guess about whether a woman is in her 30s, 40s, 50s, or 60s, I steal a glance at her hands. That's the telltale clue. It's not a bad thing. It's just the way it is, and so that's what I look at. For men, it's not quite so genteel as lines in the hand. Instead, it's wild, scraggly, rogue hair growing out of every nook and cranny from the neck up. As men get older, the hair on their head starts to thin out, while the hair peeking out from their nose and ears starts to sprout. What hair is left up top becomes more unruly, mostly, I guess, because men care about it less and so don't use a comb to keep it in line as much. Eyebrows, though, are the worst. Stiff gray hairs shoot out from all directions and over time begin to resemble the jack straws dropped on the table at the start of a game of pickup sticks. Women are aware of their hands. Many spend hours moisturizing and soaking and exfoliating in an effort to keep their skin supple and smooth. Men, on the other hand, seem to be utterly unaware of the weedy look they get from the erratic sprigs of hair that start popping out. What's more, men don't care. When I've pointed this out to friends, they shrug it off or tell me to quit staring at them. But men should care, because appearance matters, and it matters a lot. It's not simply about being comfortable with your age or maintaining an active youthful engagement with life. It is also about looking respectable and well put together. Few men can sport an Andy Rooney look without paying a price. University of Texas economist Daniel Hammermesh has found that irrespective of type of job, people with above-average looks earn 5% more per hour than people with average looks. Gordon Patzer, dean of Roosevelt University in Chicago and founder of the Appearance Phenomenon Institute, has found that the information cues people take away from looks and appearance not only provide an edge in income, they confer more social power. So what's an average-looking person to do? The answer, it seems, is to be more conscientious about grooming and behavior in order to compensate and, in particular, to make good first impressions, which tend to shape and color all subsequent interactions that people have with one another. Of course, we shouldn't expect this to make us any happier. Research is very clear that things like money, fame, and looks are not correlated with happiness. And that, perhaps, is the biggest paradox of all. What helps us with the ways that other people feel about us provides little help for the ways in which we feel about ourselves. Intrinsic things like relationships, personal growth, and community involvement make us happier. Extrinsic things like looks don't add much to our sense of well-being. And maybe that's why older guys like me look at themselves in the mirror each morning and ignore all the wild hairs. Because they feel pretty good on the inside, whatever it looks like on the outside. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. There's more Smart City for you online. Go to smartcityradio.com, where you can download past shows, sign up for our newsletter, and get links to our guest work. You can also subscribe to our podcast and get Smart City delivered straight to you. You can also get in touch with us, click on the contact button, or send email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. I'm Carol Coletta.